Thank you, Miguel. Thank you to the Biosafety Alliance. Is this working?
Yes,
it's working. And being in this church brings me fond memories of the first Battle of Seattle. And of course, you know, what got me connected to the whole issue of World Trade Organization was that in 1987, I was very fortunate to attend a meeting where the big agrochemical companies were now preparing to move into biotechnology. And at that point, they had no product on the market. It was still a strategy, and they laid out the strategy. They were very honest to say the reason we've got to do genetic engineering is it's the only way we can claim patents on life. And the real objective is to claim patents. Because if money is what matters, then a patent becomes a way to make money through royalties, because a patent is a claim to invention which allows the patent holder to exclude everyone else from owning, making, selling, distributing, whatever is patented. But when it comes to seed, a patent on seed means you can prevent farmers from saving seeds. You can prevent farmers from exchanging seeds. You can prevent farmers from having their own seed, which is the kind of laws being pushed under what is called compulsory registration, very often through originally French legislation called UPOV, but very often without it. In 1995, a representative of Monsanto gave a speech soon after the WTO treaty was signed and WTO came into existence in Washington, the other Washington, D.C. The Washington I think we could all do without and be better off. You know, in India, whenever you want to say a policymaker has the wrong point of view, they say, oh, they suffer from the Washington syndrome. The issue of the Washington syndrome is, of course, not just that the World Bank and IMF are there, but because corporate rule globally is implemented via Washington. And that's what happened with the intellectual property issue. There was no term called intellectual property. There was patents, copyrights, design, all distinctive protections. And then it was all mixed up into one intellectual property. And a representative of Monsanto, James Enyart, in 1995 said, we've achieved something unprecedented. We wrote a law, took it to our government, which then imposed it to the rest of the governments. We were the patient, the physician, and the diagnostician all in one. Now, how were they the patients? They were patients because farmers were saving seeds. And Monsanto was falling ill, because they weren't able to make profits as long as farmers saved seeds. And they offered a solution. It should now be an intellectual property crime. And that's the day I decided I was going to fight WTO, was going to fight patents and seed, and fight GMOs for the freedom of life and freedom of farmers and freedom of all people. And since we are in a very beautiful church, you know, we can even talk about the fact that GMOs, in effect, cosmologically, means God move over. Don't need you anymore. We are the creators and inventors, and we'll be the rent collectors for the rest of our life. So actually, even the first Battle of Seattle was about all of this. I remember a young student. We never expected the number of students who came. One student grabbed me on the streets and said, I'm here because of your book, Biopiracy, which is where we'd started to say, once corporations have a monopoly on life, these will be the kind of things that will happen. You all have started through your movement. 522. Salmon on one side, corn on the other. I love it. It's the only place where the fish have entered the discussion, because usually it's corn and soya only. And your vote, your movement and your vote is not just against GMOs. It is a vote for seed freedom and food freedom. And there's no way that that vote can lose in the long run. A few hiccups, we shouldn't worry. Hiccups is part of it. How long did people have to fight against slavery? How long did our countries have to fight against colonialism? You know, if we thought it would be like instant coffee of Nestle, we'd have given up. But we know movements aren't instant. You know, Phil is here in the room, and I think you and I were the two people in the ecology movement in 1992 at the Earth Summit, which were naming biotechnology as an ecological problem. And if we were demanding instant results, it wouldn't have happened. You know, he's growing old, I'm growing old, and we are still having fun. You know, in my worldview, nothing is a thing. I'm trained in quantum theory. There aren't things in the world. They're connections. I did a PhD on the non-separability in quantum theory. But there's non-separability in everything. So when we look at GMOs, we need to look at the relationships they engender. Not just the corn with a toxic gene or Roundup-resistant gene. And unfortunately, they engender very toxic relationships. The most serious toxic relationship is by hijacking our democracies. Not one GMO would be in the market if people's consensus was the basis of making decisions about our agriculture, our food. And in fact, the first thing that corporations like Monsanto must do is destroy democracy, corrupt governments, by decisions. So you had your strange Monsanto Protection Act pop out in a budget law, and that too in the defense expenditure part. I guess they knew they should be in the defense expenditure part because they're now working so closely with Blackwater. So, you know, for them it's all about a militarized approach to life. In India, they are trying their Monsanto Protection Act to undo a law we've had since 1989, pre-Rio. Our scientists were so visionary. They said, we cannot afford to do genetic engineering without a biosafety regulation. And we got our laws in 1989, and we've used those laws very effectively. I used our laws to stop Monsanto in 98 from commercializing its BT cotton. Of course, in the 4 years between 98 and 2002, they found the politicians to bribe and the bureaucrats to bribe, and they finally got an approval. But there is no approval for any GMO food in India in spite of all of Monsanto's pressure, not one. They tried a BT eggplant 2010, and actually, they started the trials in 2007. And we started a movement. And, you know, in our movement, we both do resistance. We say no to the GMOs. But we say a yes to a lot of things. Right here in this church, in another room, during Seattle, the protests, the Diverse Women for Diversity, which is a movement that grew out of protecting biodiversity and fighting GMOs, we had a beautiful diversity lunch cooked by local women. So for the BT egg plant, one of our big things was, you know, we have not just 4,500 varieties of eggplant in India. India is the home of eggplant. But we cook it in so many different ways, unbelievably diverse ways. So we had celebrations and dinner time, and we, you know, got children involved, and they wrote to the ministers, prime minister, health minister. And when they still got an approval, we pushed the government to have public debates. And the environment minister of that time held public debates in 7 cities of India. Which meant that he got to listen to the farmers, he got to listen to the women, he got to listen to the local scientists who know much more about what's going on. And in some places, the scientists would say, but there is no pest in the brinjal, in the native brinjal. And this was very interesting because during these public hearings, they were going to fly Nina Fedorov, who you know, is a big pusher of biotech and was your Secretary of State's technology ambassador. And I got a message, would I meet her? And I said, of course I'll meet her. But I knew why she was coming. Luckily, you had a storm in the other Washington. And she couldn't fly the day she wanted to fly. And we got the decision preponed by a day. So by the time she arrived, the moratorium had already been announced. And your vice president is actually visiting us now, trying to scold us as they always do. You've got to strengthen your intellectual property rights. You've got to strengthen your intellectual property rights. And very often our government sort of chickens in, but sometimes they get guts. A few weeks ago, our patent office rejected one of the broadest patent claims of Monsanto. It's for all climate resilience of all crops. And the patent office basically, ruling on the basis of clauses we've been able to put in to our patent act in spite of all the pressures of the WTO, we have 2 very strong clauses. One is in Article 3D, which says a new use of a known substance is not an invention. And 3J, and I think, you know, our movement had a big role in this. 3J says you can't patent life. You can't patent biological processes. Now, Monsanto has a very clever definition of a biological process and non-biological processes. Basically, there are only 2 ways to create a genetically engineered organism. Either shoot with a gene gun. And if you want to see this, there's a film on called Bullshit, which a filmmaker from Sweden made on my debates with me, because Monsanto's representatives gave me a Bullshit Award in Johannesburg for making the world starve with organic, and they gave me cow dung. I said, you can call it bullshit, I'll call it cow dung, I'll still make compost, we'll still do organic farming. Thank you so much. You have contributed to the food security of the world. Now, repeatedly, the Monsanto arguments have been that without their genetic engineering, the world can't be fed. And now the data is out clear because we've got 20 years of experience with GMOs. First, the claim of hunger. Nowhere have yields increased because of genetic engineering. Because as I was saying, you can either shoot with a gene gun or infect with a plant cancer. That's all you can do. Doesn't change the yield. The yield comes from the original plant, which you have now infected. Now, that act of shooting is not an act of creating. I mean, that's what I say, the illusion of capitalist patriarchy. You know? You destroy and say you create. And this illusion of creation is what really needs a lot of sorting out. Part of it is a mental disease, so it needs a lot of psychiatric help. But surely, I mean, if you're destroying something and you say you're creating it, something has to be wrong. So they shoot a gene, and it's usually only 2 toxic genes, yeah? Either a BT toxin, where they put a pesticide into the plant, or a Roundup resistant or herbicide resistant toxin, also a toxin. That's all they've achieved in 20 years. When this debate started, they were going to grow food on the moon, in the Sahara, on toxic dumps. All they've been able to do is chop the Amazon, destroy farming, and turn fertile soils into deserts. We've done studies. The BT toxin crops are not just killing the bees, and they're not just killing the pollinators, they're killing the soil organisms. We were doing a study on soils, and then I just thought, why not look at what BT is doing? All the beneficial organisms gone. And while the beneficial organisms are being killed, pathogens are growing. Very important studies done now by Dr. Huber, who's the one who started to figure out why so many cows were having abortions, why reproduction failure was so high in animals now. And it turns out it's because pathogens are growing so much in soil contaminated with glyphosate and glyphosate-resistant and Roundup-resistant seeds. So the story, we were given more food and less chemicals. Do we have less chemicals? No. 13 times more pesticide use in the BT cotton areas of central India. These are primary study. All we do is go talk to the pesticide salespeople. How much are you selling today compared to when BT wasn't being used? These are figures of sales and figures of use. Charles Benbrook has, in his study, shown 15% increase in herbicide use. And it's inevitable because the tools that are being developed are so crude. First, you really don't know what's going on. When you're shooting a gene, you don't know what's going on in the genome. Then you don't know what's happening with the organism, and you don't know what the organism is doing within an ecosystem. So before you know it, you've got super pests and super weeds. The bollworm for which the BT cotton was evolved is resistant. So now they've got bollworm two, and they're preparing bollworm three, and they've got smart stacks, eight toxic genes. But each of those genes is failing to do the job it was meant to do. Roundup resistant has resistant seeds have led to emergence of superweeds on 70 million acres of this country. 70 million. Half the farms of the United States are overtaken by weeds that can't be controlled. And now Agent Orange is being recommended because Roundup isn't good enough. Now, Agent Orange was created for violence against Vietnam. So when you say no GMOs, you are saying we will not allow this land, this country, to be turned into a war zone. You know, of course, there are hazards. And we know there's political control and concentration through monopolies. But there are costs that are often not talked about. I find it fascinating that one of the most serious costs that we've had through GMOs in India, and as I said, the only crop that we have is BT cotton. As soon as Monsanto entered India and it started to buy up Indian seed companies or lock them into licensing arrangements, and today the stage has reached when 60 Indian companies have licensing arrangements with Monsanto and cannot sell anything else. They cannot sell a non-GM seed. They cannot sell their own seeds. These were companies that did seed business. But the licensing arrangement says, just like for in your country you have contracts between farmers and Monsanto. In India, the contracts are between companies and Monsanto, and that is how they destroy the market. And that is how in just a little over a decade, they've managed to take over 95% of the cotton seed supply. Now, the promoters of biotech will say, oh, the proof that 95% farmers are sowing is that they like it. And we always have to say, no, it's because this alternative has been destroyed, and that's why we're building an alternative. Navdanya, which has created 110 community seed banks around the country, is now creating seed banks for the last 5 years in the area where BT cotton has become the monopoly. The seed costs jumped 8,000%. The old seed is renewable. This seed has to be bought every year. Not just once, maybe three times, five times, because it's so ill-adapted that it fails. And farmers have to buy again and again. Do they have the money to buy? No. So how do they finance this? How does Monsanto's profits keep growing? How do they get $200 million of royalty collection annually from India, from cotton alone? The debt that farmers take is usually from private creditors, because from the banks it's impossible to take too often. The creditors are the same businesses that sell the pesticides and the seeds. And they don't lose. They don't lose because when the farmer can't pay, they come say, the land is now ours because land was mortgaged. And farmers losing their land drink pesticide to end their lives. The figures of suicides driven by these kinds of seed monopolies, majority of them in the cotton belt of India, this year has hit 284,694, more than a quarter million farmers. Now, there was an article in Nature said, oh, there's talk of superweeds. Yes, we agree there's superweeds. Superpests, yes, they're superpests. But suicides, no, we don't agree. And then they do this national figure of farmers, talk about the percentage, how it's such a small percentage dying. Let me read the figures from the area which is the capital of BT cotton and the capital of suicides. The suicides in 2001, they started after 95. 2001, in this region called Vidarbha, it was 52. 2002 is when BT cotton gets introduced, it jumps to 104. 2003, and every year the cotton area, the BT area is growing. And every year the suicide area's numbers are growing. 2003, 148. 2004, 447. 2005, 445. 2006, 1,148. 2007, 1,246. I have called this a genocide. And of course, Monsanto gets extremely troubled. And they're even more troubled now because not only do we say it's a genocide, our parliament said it's a genocide. The Standing Committee on Agriculture, every party, including the ruling party, after visiting these suicide areas, said there's no place for GMOs in India. So the Indian parliament stands with you. The Supreme Court of India set up a technical expert committee, which has just submitted its report. First, they say for 10 years or more, till we get up proper biosafety systems in place, no BT crops. Herbicide-resistant crops never, because we are a land of diversity. We are small farms, and everything green is useful. Either it's a vegetable that gets rid of vitamin A deficiency and iron deficiency, or it's fodder for your animals. India is the biggest dairy industry of the world, but it's based on one and two animals per unit, not factory farms. And the biggest cooperatives have been created around the women who look after the animals. Those greens are fodder. When we were having the discussions around the Convention on Biological Diversity, I remember at a particular convention meeting, and Monsanto was always pushing the GMO option and trying to block biosafety. President Bush walked out of Rio because we managed to get biosafety clauses in, and I was appointed by the UN to be in the Framework Committee to to define the framework of a protocol that became the Cartagena Protocol, and of course Phil knows so much about it. But I remember in one of those early meetings, a representative of Monsanto got up and said, these Roundup-ready crops are so smart that they prevent the weeds from stealing the sunshine. Now, it's because for them, the weeds are stealing the sunshine, they steal the nutrition from people. Because when they spray, they're killing the food. And after they've created deficiencies, they say, oh, now we'll make a vitamin A rice, which will solve the problem of blindness, rather than say, stop spraying and let the greens grow. I've done studies, 250 species of greens grow voluntarily in the farms of India, which are a base of food, and they go with women's knowledge. So far we've managed to stop the golden rice, but you know, every once in a while, recently the agriculture minister of UK said those who are fighting golden rice are killing people. And every once in a while you get this thing of killing people. The latest they've evolved is a banana enriched with iron. Now, a banana is such a delicious fruit. It is a magical fruit. In fact, it's called the fruit that gives everything. And I realized while doing the research on this that its scientific name, Musa Sapientum, comes from the fact that Alexander, he came to conquer India, and he found all these people eating bananas, especially the sages. And he says, the wise people eat this amazing fruit, and he introduced banana to the West. So Musa Sapientum, now a very unwise idea of genetically engineering the Musa Sapientum for increasing iron content. Iron isn't the best gift of the banana. It has only 0.44 grams, milligrams. But we have so many foods that do provide a lot of iron. Turmeric, we eat it every day in our sabzis and our dals, 67.8, tamarind pulp 17, poppy seeds 15.9, mango powder, we dry mango powder for saring, 45, neem 25, buckwheat 15, I could go on and on and on. Now where does this crazy idea of genetically engineering banana for iron, and then saying this project is going to prevent Indian women from dying in childbirth because of anemia? It comes from the city, Mr. Gates. So we have a problem with Monsanto, but we also have a problem with Mr. Gates. At some point it has to be. Now Gates is financing one scientist, Australian Mr. Dale, to do genetic engineering of banana, not in the Central American republics, they call the banana republics, but in India and Uganda. Why? Because for us, you know, India is the biggest producer of banana. In Uganda, banana is the staple. They don't eat rice and wheat. They eat banana. But in India, we have a lot of diversity. And Dale already has patents on the banana. So genetic engineering is always a means to own the diversity. It's a means for biopiracy, which is why the fight against GMOs must join the fight against biopiracy and for the rights of indigenous people, farmers and peasants. The No to GMO Banana campaign is a yes to indigenous biodiversity and knowledge. And join it. It's available on the Navdanya website, NAVDANYA. And we should all make it ours. And when you've, you know, won the labeling vote, then we'll turn to bringing sanity to Mr. Gates. Because he quite clearly suffers from this illusion that he's creating when he's destroying. All the biotech industry has first joined him for AGRA, the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa, when we know the damages the Green Revolution did in India. Now the industry's got together with a new vision for Africa, which is the old vision of colonization. Take over Africa. Land grab, seed grab, biodiversity grab. There was a vote recently in the UN Human Rights Commission, and the US government refused to recognize peasant rights, saying it is creating new rights. So it's very interesting. They create new rights like intellectual property rights and seed, and they treat the ancient rights of farmers to seed, to save seed, to exchange seed, as a new right. They create a new right to grab land, and they call the ancient rights of peoples who are ancestors, whose ancestors have habitated that land, and they call that ancestral right a new right. And this comes from a particular kind of thinking about rights that was related to colonization. The legal juridical category that was created for colonization was terra nullius, empty land. The native people of this land were not people. Aborigines in Africa were not people. They were fauna and flora. And the argument that the indigenous people here, the First Nations, were not people was very interesting, because they don't put their cows into a fence. For Australia, it was brilliant. They don't cultivate apple. Why should they? You know, they got all the wild lands. So they took a European measure and said, you don't do this. In any case, you know, when I was writing my book on patents, biopiracy, I wanted to figure out where did this word come from, the word patent. And it didn't come from invention. It came from what Columbus was carrying, a letter's patent, a letter, open letter. Patent means open, because the conspiracy letters were sealed. Takeover letters were open to go to other people's land and declare this is mine. And the papal bull had said, you can take other people's territory. And that's what Columbus's open letter said. Go find places not ruled by white Christian princes and declare them as the territory of the European kings and queens. And exactly that same thing is now being done to life as was done to land. I call it bio nullius. Assume life is empty. Yeah? It's empty till you put a toxic gene, then you've created it. Yeah? It is empty till you've put an iron into banana. There's no iron in the biodiversity of nature. It's empty because only Monsanto and Mr. Gates have brains. The rest of us don't. Because you know, what's intellectual property right, technically translated, is a property in the product of the mind, which in effect is saying all the corn evolution of the peoples of Mexico and Peru and other places and Native Americans, no, that was not intellectual work. And the category given to this in the literature is land races, you know, as if all of this diversity of corn and 200,000 rice varieties popped out of the land. Just like that. Popped out. But the GMOs popped out of Monsanto's head. But Monsanto is a corporation. It is a legal fiction that it's a person. So it's a fiction that it has a brain or a mind. And therefore it's a fiction that it has property in the mind. So one of our big challenges is to deal with the fictions and the illusions that rule us. And this is not just a scientific debate. Of course, science has a role. But it's also a debate about creativity. Where does creativity come from? It's a debate about thinking differently and a change in worldview. And it's a contest at one level of whether the power of money and the power of brute force will be stronger than the creative energies and creative potential of all of us in our different places. Now, if I have worked so long on these issues, it's because I have a deep faith that dictatorships don't last. While they're at their peak, they seem to be all-powerful and all-permanent. And that's exactly how Hitler must have felt. We have new Hitlers, they're corporations. And we have to learn how to deal with these new dictatorships. So we have to bring all the creative energies that every movement of independence has mobilized, every creative energy that every freedom movement and democratic movement has mobilized. And we have to do more, because throughout history it was about people's enslavement. This is the first time people's enslavement and enslavement of the diversity of life on the planet is being handled together. So we have an opportunity to connect the struggles of farmers' right to sieve, your right to labeling, and the right of the beast to survive, the right of the earthworms and microorganisms to survive, the right of biodiversity to flourish. And that's why we started a seed freedom campaign, and I had sent a copy of this, but I'm going to leave another one. This is a global report on all the seed sanctuaries, but also all the seed struggles, the kind of laws being brought. And without seed freedom, we can't have food freedom. But over the years, I've also realized that while all of us, all the time, after all, we eat three times a day, and three times a day, we must make a difference to the food system by our everyday choices. But sometimes it's good to connect, and it's good to turn our energies like a laser. And for very long, I have always worked on the fortnight of 2nd of October to the 16th of October as Food Freedom Fortnight. 2nd October is Gandhi's birth anniversary. And there are two lessons for me from Gandhi that are so important. First, the defining of real freedom. Real freedom is defined by people, not by corporations. So, if free trade is about taking away the right to know what you're eating, it's unfree trade. If free trade imposes laws that prevent farmers from saving seeds, it's unfree. But the second thing that Gandhi taught us, and to me that has been the most precious, is as long as the superstition exists that unjust laws must be obeyed, so long will slavery exist. And that is why he created the language of Satyagraha, the fight for truth. He practiced it in South Africa on September 11th, 1901, saying no to apartheid. He practiced it in India against the salt laws. We've practiced it against the seed laws. And to date, we have prevented any law being put forward in India that would make it illegal for farmers to enjoy seed freedom. And we need to do this everywhere. 16th of October is World Food Day. This year, around that time, Monsanto is going to give itself the World Food Prize, because it is a sponsor of the prize it's giving. And we thought it would be just wonderful around that period, in that fortnight, everywhere, to give the real food prize from real people to real food heroes, the local organic producers. This would also make every community recognize how rich and abundant their community is. Because one of the big ideas that we have to make bigger is small farms produce more. Local systems are more productive. In Navdanya, we've done studies that show that biodiverse farms produce much more food and higher incomes for producers. Monocultures don't. Chemical farming takes the incomes away because money is being drained out. But also local systems are the only way to create real food democracy. The long-distance chains of Walmart are wasting 50% of the food and then not bringing us the kind of food that we need to eat. All of the GM corn and soya is only 10% in the human, directly eaten. Most of it is going as biofuel and the rest is going as animal feed. Commodities do not feed people. Growing more commodities creates starvation. Growing more food is what we need. And we need millions of gardens. I hope in this area, as part of your fight against GMOs, you will adopt the positive movement that we are spreading of seeds of freedom for gardens of hope. That every place should be a garden. Every place we can find, a school, a community center, a farm, wherever. And as we realize that food doesn't come from these giant corporations, we can create the food systems. We'll, of course, demand everything we should from the governments and the corporations. But more importantly, we must dedicate ourselves to the creative acts that are in our hands so that we can be the change we want to see. More organic farms, more local farms, more democratic and resilient food communities will not only grow more food, they will, most importantly, grow more freedom. Thank you. Thank you.